This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The main goal of palliative care is to ease suffering for patients with serious health conditions and also to relieve the suffering of their families. That suffering takes many forms: pain, physical difficulties, mental stress. Palliative care is a little bit different than hospice care in that anyone with a serious illness can theoretically have a palliative care team helping to provide care like this. It doesn't have to be just at the end of life, and it doesn't prevent patients from getting treatment designed to extend life or cure a disease. In some ways, it seems like this should just be a part of care, not special treatment from a special team. Isn't the relief of suffering fundamental to the job of being a healthcare provider? Maybe so, but this medical specialty is having a particularly prominent moment. At the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, a big new center for palliative and hospice care is just about to be built. And a $3 million gift to UVM from philanthropists Holly and Bob Miller is designed to strengthen palliative and end-of-life care for patients at the UVM Medical Center and through the college's medicine curriculum. Today on the show, we're going to explore the value of palliative care and how it's being integrated into medical coverage with the new endowed chair of the palliative care department at the UVM College of Medicine, Dr. Robert Gramling. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks for having me.
And welcome to Vermont. I take it you're new here?
Yeah, brand new to Vermont.
Well, yes. We're happy to have you.
Thank you.
So I sketched out a definition, but you can no doubt color it in much more vibrantly about exactly what palliative care is and does.
You know, Jane, I have to say I was impressed with your definition. You know, we as a discipline have worked hard to, particularly the last few years, to begin to define who we are and what we do. And because the last thing we want to do is further confuse people by adding another group of people into their care. The piece that I really enjoyed hearing of your definition was the fact that you were addressing this concept of suffering. And you asked the important question of why is not this definition part of everything we do? And I think on a visceral level, we want it to be. But I believe our system, particularly medical care, has, although a long, centuries-long tradition understanding what this word suffering meant, particularly in the modern era, has lost a little connection to it. I think our nursing colleagues have helped keep us grounded to it a little bit better, and we borrow pretty heavily from them in this reemergence of this thing we call palliative care. So maybe your listeners might help if I explain that a little bit. So suffering, I remember as a medical student carrying around in my backpack a really important paper by Eric Cassell in the 1980s, early 1980s. It was titled The Nature of Suffering and the Goals of Medicine. And the key distinction here is that disease is experienced by tissues and cells and organs and ultimately bodies, whereas suffering is experienced by persons. And we have developed an exquisite system for diagnosing and treating disease. Exceptional. What we have lost is the science and the art and the systems to diagnose and treat suffering. And so I can speak more to that if you'd like, but let me take a break and see what
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, and it makes sense that, you know, one of the issues here is not that doctors aren't focused on relieving suffering. It's that this idea of, you know, how do you do that? How do you integrate that? And how does that all become a part of medical care? And I understand for you, part of the big issue is communication, you know, that there's maybe a gap, but maybe I'm putting my own words in here, but a gap in effective communication between doctors and patients and patients' families. And then you say that actually has a significant impact on medical care and quality of life if you're not having good communication back and forth between those two channels. And that's part of palliative care as well.
Absolutely. So I talked briefly about suffering in contrast to disease. And if suffering is experienced by persons, in order for us to diagnose it, we have got to understand the person. We have to know who they are. We have to know what their identities are and how their disease, their symptoms, and the medical treatments that face them, how that impacts on their identity and their personhood. When we have a good understanding of that, we can help navigate what types of information would be helpful for them, what types of other symptom control medications would be helpful for them, what other types of existential, spiritual, psychological, emotional, and practical supports would be helpful to them. And there's no other way of doing this. There's, as a friend of mine would say, there's no probe for to put in a person and tell them who they are. we get that by communicating well and being present. So at the fundamental basis of what we do is that relational communication.
Is it a factor of our current medical system that is preventing that kind of communication and then requires a separate specialty or a separate team to sort of facilitate that? I mean, is it the fact that in many cases still, despite changes that that we're trying to make in medical practices, it's sort of in and out with your doctor and you don't have a lot of time and the doctor's under pressure to get patients in and out and seen and maybe not spend the time to find out who that patient is and what she cares about?
So the short answer is yes. The longer answer is we are in an important moment of change here that UVM, one of the big attractive pieces to me for this area is that as you acknowledge that we have been rewarded, whether it's pay or social status or identity, by doing more things to people. And we are now changing our times, both in the way healthcare is financed, is to see if we can reach more people and if we can do things well based on the terms that matter to patients and families in their communities. And that sounds like a nuanced change, but it is really going to be a frame shift for us. And things like communication are going to be valued, and we have to adapt and be ready for that.
We're going to get into a little bit more of what exactly palliative care entails and what it looks like if you're a patient. But I know many of you out there have had some experience with palliative care for you or a loved one. I'd love to know how it fit into the rest of your medical treatment, what you think about the value of having a palliative care team be a part of treatment. And maybe you have questions. Maybe some of this has you asking about the own care that you've received or questions about how it all works. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Catherine who says, of the many forms of healthcare, this is the area that seems to truly get it right. So much caring to bring comfort. A comfortable end of life and painless passing is the goal and is the focus 24/7. So much transpires at this time. Palliative care allows the patient to be present with it all. Thank you for highlighting this thoughtful topic. Dr. Gramling, maybe you can, palliative care in that context sounds a lot like hospice care, but it is a little bit different. Can you outline some of the differences?
I can try. And one reason that this question is a pretty familiar one is that we share a very deep rooting in addressing the concepts of suffering. Hospice is an insurance benefit. With it comes some regulations, including an expectation of life, of duration of life, which is 6 months or less for two physicians to expect more often than not that would be the case in this situation. And for the patient, for the disease for which they qualify for hospice, to choose not to pursue primarily life-extending treatments. And in our American culture, that's a tough choice for people. We're not trained to think of that in a way that is balanced. And so it presents for many, oftentimes until they understand what it is and actually experience it, a formidable barrier for some people.
So for a palliative care team to come in, can I get a couple of examples maybe of diseases? So for somebody who maybe has a rare form of cancer that has a high fatality rate and they're pursuing treatment, they might still be eligible to have a palliative care team come in and help work with them on suffering while they're also undergoing this treatment?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And our job, as I'd mentioned before, would be to understand who they are, what's happening to them and around them and with them, and to help navigate. The choices are our society and our medical culture is not getting simpler, and people are faced with lots of confusing options. And having someone who can just sit and be with that is oftentimes of use.
So what else? Something like multiple sclerosis, something that may be a devastating medical condition for somebody but isn't likely to kill them in the next 6 months, something like that? Is that also – I mean, what kinds of illnesses and diseases are you working with?
So I could give you a list, and if I do so, I am sure that I'm going to forget really important ones. But maybe I'll give a concept for people. We oftentimes refer to this concept of serious illness, and we leave it ill-defined, which I'll take a stab at it here. I think if there's a possibility of major loss, whether that's dying, whether that's loss of dependent or independence, or whether it's a loss to quality of life, however you define it, from this disease within a time horizon that matters to you, then that's the right time. And that time horizon can be hours, days, months, years. It could be decades. But that's really the fundamental piece, that there's an impending or perceived loss that we can potentially help navigate with people.
You mentioned that hospice care is an insurance benefit. Is palliative care typically covered under insurance? Is it something that, how does cost factor into it, I guess? Because if hospice is a medical benefit, what's palliative care?
Yes, it's a medical specialty that will be covered under most people's insurance. We are right now primarily a hospital discipline, also in the state of Vermont, meaning that we're consulted to visit with patients and families who are hospitalized. One of my and my team's charges is to begin engineering what it means to extend palliative care outside of our walls to all of Vermonters. And that presents a lot of creative opportunity and some potential challenges, and including understanding what cost means. If the more I learn about cost, the more I'm fascinated by our inability to define that as well.
So you don't have a sense of whether this is something that costs more to the medical system but is worth it in quality of life, or somehow, costs less because it is improving quality of life of patients and that has some tangible medical benefits.
Well, I think the growing science of palliative care observes that palliative care results in lower costs, oftentimes because just talking about things that are happening, patients are making choices that I really don't see the benefit of. Why am I doing that? But that's also a careful way we measure cost, is we're going to have a more mature way of thinking about that, because caring for people who are very sick involves medical bills. It involves loss of work time. It involves needing help at home. There's societal costs that really are the next steps for us to be thinking about how to do that well in order to really serve the people that we need to serve.
One of the pictures that I'm getting in my head then of what you do is I hesitate to define you this way because I could see it, you could bristle at it, but it almost sounds like you're a talking doctor. You come in and talk to people. Is that accurate?
Yes, Jane, it's accurate. But I like to think of myself as a listening doctor. And I'd like to think that was not strange, but oftentimes you don't have that many of them. So I listen and I talk, but I listen probably more than I talk.
So do you need a medical specialty for that? Why couldn't we have people who just have really wonderful communication skills come in and be facilitators instead of having a sort of specialized branch of medicine?
We could. Here's the piece that's important is the science of what we do. I mean, listening well, communicating well, that is essential. But people also want our medical advice. They want me to be able to say, what information are you lacking to make this decision? Would you like my opinion on whether this treatment will achieve the goals you're asking of me? And they need me to have that background and that readiness. And I bring my pathophysiologic understanding, my experience with treatments, and I bring that with me. And without it, would I be of value? Absolutely. But that is a fundamental piece that a lot of what I'm doing is actually quite intense medical decision making, maybe in a little bit different model than people are used to.
So you do help people decide, should I carry on with this treatment or not? Should I, do some things to retrofit my house or not? What is my prognosis? How do I understand it? That kind of communication is what you're often doing with patients?
Absolutely. Would you like an example?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So a brief story, because just to give some pragmatics of what we do and when we would call this a success. So our team was called to help a man, we'll call him James, who'd been struggling with congestive heart or heart failure in the hospital setting. His team got a sense that this is not improving, and they're concerned that his condition is declining and that they might need to call the intensive care unit team and be reaching for things such as a mechanical ventilator for him. And they were concerned that he just wasn't understanding what was happening. and they were feeling moral distress around this, so they asked us to come. And to illustrate some of the issues of disease and suffering, sitting with James, it didn't take long to recognize a few things, that shortness of breath was bothering him, and we could address that and did, that he was confused and fearful. But he wasn't suffering from the shortness of breath. Where his suffering was, and this kind of unfolded in our conversation, was that he knew what was happening. He knew this wasn't getting better. He knew where he was headed. He heard the doctors and nurses talking to him. What mattered to him was his legacy. He was a man who grew up in backbreaking poverty. He wanted his grandchildren to go away understanding that their grandpa got the best that was possible. And for him, the best meant being in the high-tech environment and for him dying there. And so we could move the conversation to saying, okay, James, we know what's happening. How long do you need to be in the intensive care unit? Because you can't be talking to us once we need to use these machines. And he asked me for my advice about what would be the simple, fixable things. And without much hesitation, he's like, 48 hours. Anything longer than 48 hours, I do not want to be in the intensive care unit. That's long enough for my grandchildren to see me there, and I don't want my family to be thinking about decisions for me. I want my voice to be heard. So what we were able to do in that thing is identify what his suffering was. I could come back and talk to the team and say, no, you're doing a wonderful job for James, and we're going to be here to help figure this out together, talk to his family about what his voice is so they knew it was coming. And it unfolded just like he had expected, and without the trauma and burden to the family of trying to make decisions and wondering what he would want, his spirit was there. And I certainly hope his grandchildren are listening and appreciate that his grandpa was driving the bus.
We're talking about palliative care today, a medical specialty that's getting a big boost in our region and beyond right now. And I would love to know, listeners, what questions you have about how palliative care is integrated with curative care, what it means to get palliative care, and how primary care doctors are thinking about incorporating this into their own practices and training. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're learning about what palliative care is, why it's a branch of medicine that's gaining in recognition and prominence. UVM Medical Center just had a chair endowed that shines a spotlight on this type of care, and we're speaking with the doctor who's taking that new position, Dr. Robert Gramling. Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center is just about to break ground on a new palliative care and hospice center, and the integration of palliative care into traditional physician training is a conversation ongoing at medical schools around the country. If you have an experience with palliative care that you'd like to share, or a question for Dr. Gramling, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Naomi is calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Naomi. Go right ahead.
Hi. I wanted to say that my sister died of cancer in 2011, and this is in California. She had been, in therapy to cure her cancer, and California, actually when Reagan was governor, determined that you either had to choose to continue to work, toward a cure, or you could choose palliative care, but you couldn't have both. And so at a point when she really didn't know the answer to whether she would recover, she was too sick to go on. She had to choose palliative care, which in a lot of ways was a pretty terrible choice. And she ultimately died, which she may have anyway, but I always wonder, how much that impacted her chances.
Well, Naomi, thank you for sharing your story, and I'm very sorry about your sister's experience and her death. Dr. Gramling, this brings up that idea that many people may have about palliative care, that it is something that, like hospice care, is something that requires you to choose between comfort and life-extending treatment. And it sounds like from Naomi's sister's experience, that may have been the case in California many years ago, but that's not the case in how it works now.
Yeah, Naomi, I'm unable to speak about the policies back with your sister. And let me also offer, if you'd like to say her first name, we're happy to hear it.
Naomi dropped off the line.
She did. Okay. So what I was hearing from Naomi was similar to what we might consider as a hospice condition in our modern time right now. Palliative care doesn't ask people to make such a decision, and oftentimes what we're doing is navigating that. You know, a lot of, even in Atul Gawande's book, for those who hadn't read it, I've recommended highly, Being Mortal, you know, we'll make the observations that it's sometimes that this letting go or this decision, people end up living longer. If for no other reason than their body is struggling less with the treatments to treat a disease that aren't working, or maybe other yet to be identified processes, but it isn't a foregone conclusion that choosing not to try a treatment that has high risks and potentially low benefits is in any way shortening your life. For some people that might be true, for others that may not.
Let's hear from Brent calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Brent, your turn.
You mean Frank?
Yes, go right ahead, Frank.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, not Brent. my wife passed away with leukemia almost 5 years ago. And we had Dr. Diana Barnard was the palliative care specialist down here, and they since closed that program. Unfortunately, she's still up at UVM. But anyway, my comment is that my wife was terminally ill, but she was pretty functional up until the last couple weeks. But the palliative care was very holistic in my mind. In other words, this person, Diana Barnard, became a counselor, an advocate, a liaison. She dovetailed really well with home health and hospice and, offered a level of service other than just pain control that the oncologist couldn't do. I mean, he just can't do it from UVM. My wife died at home and was at home the whole time. Diana Barnard came, called. You could call her any time of day or night. So I just want to emphasize the holisticness of it. It was more than palliative, like pain, whatever. You know, it was all about really being a counselor and an advocate. And she was incredible. And the whole program was just incredible. And it made a huge difference in her passing.
Frank, it's really great to hear that. And I appreciate you sharing your wife's story and your story. Has it made you think at all about your own medical care if you find yourself suffering from a medical condition?
I'd like to be treated the same way. Yeah. It was such a great thing, and the comfort and the counseling, and she would actually ask me to leave the room and talk to my wife privately, so my wife was able to say whatever she wanted to say, without fear of making me worry, and because she had her own private thoughts too, It was just unbelievable. Really. And the palliative thing was great. And when we needed morphine and the time came, it was fantastic. But to have that taken care of, but it was really much, much more than that. It was an advocacy and a counseling that's hard to actually describe how good it was.
Well, Frank, I appreciate you taking the time to share it with us. And Dr. Gramling, that's a little bit what you were explaining before, that this is more than just about pain maintenance. It really is about what a patient, what a person and that person's family wants to have happen to them.
Yes, Frank, thank you for sharing your story and your wife's story. And if it is any piece of joy for you, it is to know that Dr. Barnard is still part of our team here and is part of the evolving conversation about how do we do this better for all Vermonters. So she'll enjoy hearing that her work was of value for you and your wife.
What is that conversation like? What are you trying to get at?
Well, for one of the questions that you had before, Jane, was why isn't this part of all medical care? And trying to define what we might consider primary palliative care versus specialty palliative care, that's an evolving set of definitions. So as an advocate for palliative care, we need to think about the systems to put in place to allow the good doctors and nurses and around Vermont to do what they want to and can do, and then to support them as a specialty service, whether that is in person, over telehealth consulting, which has lots of opportunity if we can figure out how to communicate well over a screen, that how we really engineer our system to allow the possibility to do this human work is really the kind of the creative palette that we're working from right now.
Let's hear from Audrey, who's calling in from Rutland. Hi, Audrey. Go right ahead.
my husband died within the hospital, Rutland Hospital, and he was there for a total of like 17 days. And in that time, we realized, and I believe he did too, that with everything that was happening to his body, and the last thing that happened was he developed pneumonia, probably in both lungs. He was not going to make it. He was put on life supports, our choice, and of course he decided the last minute, even though he had an advanced directive not to, so that part of our family could arrive. And the palliative care nurse was a personal friend of my husband's, because he had worked in the Rutland hospice area years ago, and we knew her well, and she was a wonderful go-between for us and the surgeon, who said, I can save your husband, I can save your father. There were three children, but we knew that his wishes were not to spend the rest of his days in a nursing home, and so we told him, and I'm sure he heard us, because he was able to respond to the doctor's request when he was still on life support, so he couldn't talk to us, that we were going to let him go. And we did. And we spent 2.5 wonderful days with him in a suite on the 5th floor of the hospital. We slept in the same room with him. We ate in the same room with him, and we just listened to his breath just slowly ebb out of his body, and we all agreed that it was the way that their father, my husband, would want to go, and it was just wonderful that Ziva, our palliative care nurse, was able to be a go-between between the surgeon and I, so that he finally was able to say, I understand. I understand. And
Audrey, it's so pretty amazing to hear, you know, in spite of obviously how painful this was and how sad it remains for you and for your family, that, you know, the medical care and the way that unfolded for you was something that you have positive feelings about, in spite of what is obviously a very, very painful and sad situation. And I really appreciate you taking the time to call us and to tell us about your experience despite that pain. Thank you. Dr. Gramling, you know, you must have experienced family situations like Audrey's and like Frank's, and the listeners that we're hearing from. Why is this a part of medicine that you care so deeply about, that this is what you're devoting your life to?
You know, being part of people's story at a time that can be confusing and terrifying sometimes, but also extraordinarily joyful, and then all of them all together, it's being human. I mean, just the intensity of our humanness is something that I have the opportunity and the privilege of being part of, and seeing people like Audrey and her family who. Wow, Audrey, your husband, and he was so lucky to have all of you guys, and I'm left, I think, with remembering and something in Audrey's words, that those two words, I understand. If there's nothing else we get from this, wouldn't that be a lovely thing if we could always say that?
So, do you think palliative care is? I mean, is it having a moment right now? Is it something that is going to be integrated? Is it something that patients are going to see a difference if they're at UVM Medical Center, or, you know, we heard Dartmouth Hitchcock is opening its own palliative care center. This is something that's happening, you know, this idea of how do we incorporate this into medicine. Where is it going?
We have passed the tipping point, Jane. I mean, we are on the launching pad that, you know, amazing volumes of people have got us where we are today. And I think an important piece of this puzzle right now, certainly that in this time we're in, is the deep appreciation for, you know, Holly and Bob Miller's vision, because a lot of what we've been talking about is communication. We don't yet know how. We actually don't know exactly what it is, how to teach it, and how to value it as we engineer our systems, really. And their gift of an endowed chair gives the power to innovate and the ability for us to answer those critical questions that we will bring forth into the next era of medicine. It's as big as that.
Well, Dr. Robert Gramling will be in charge of doing that at UVM Medical Center with his team. He is the new Holly and Bob Miller Chair in Palliative Medicine at the UVM College of Medicine. Dr. Gramling, welcome, and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you so much, your listeners.
Coming up, Vermont Press Bureau reporter Neil Goswami fills us in on the criminal trial of Senator Norm McAllister, who's accused of several sex crimes. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. State Senator Norm McAllister is set to stand trial tomorrow on charges that he coerced a young woman who worked for him to have non-consensual sex on more than one occasion. A separate trial involves another woman who alleges sexual coercion in exchange for housing on McAllister's Franklin County farm. Here to bring us up to speed is Vermont Press Bureau Chief Neil Goswami. Hi, Neil. Nice to talk with you again.
Hey, good to be here.
Can you take us back first to May when Senator McAllister was arrested on the steps of the State House and describe the details surrounding that?
Yeah, this really took the State House by surprise in May 2015 as lawmakers were trying to wrap up the end of the legislative session. There were some state police officers that showed up at the State House and apparently took Senator McAllister into custody as he was outside on a cigarette break. There were a couple of senators, Peg Flory and others, who were out there trying to sort of help Senator McAllister deal with the situation that came up. And throughout the day and over the next couple of days, more and more details came out about the case that really left a lot of people shocked that somebody who served in the legislature could be accused of such things.
And what exactly are the charges that he is accused of?
There are three felony counts that he faces of sexual assault, and those carry a 3-year to life in prison jail terms. And then there are three misdemeanor counts of prohibited acts, which carry lesser jail times. And he's accused of, or has been accused of, sexually assaulting three different women. One woman worked on his farm in Franklin County. Another worked as a legislative assistant or intern with him in Montpelier. And a third woman has since died, and that will not go to trial.
And this was actually the mother-in-law of the woman who lives on the farm with him.
Right.
So McAllister claims that he's innocent of all these charges.
He does. And he has rejected, apparently rejected, several plea deals offered by prosecutors and has been waiting for his court date, his trial date, so that he can clear his name. And he has repeatedly told members of the media that he intends to do that.
And that starts tomorrow, right? He's going to have two separate trials. What exactly is happening tomorrow?
There are two separate trials. The first trial begins tomorrow, and that involves the legislative intern who was a teenager, allegedly a teenager when these alleged incidents first occurred or began occurring, I should say. And jury selection is going on today in Franklin County at the St. Albans Court. Lawyers from both the prosecution and defense are sort of picking through the jury pool and trying to put together a panel that will hear the case. My colleague Josh O'Gorman reported earlier this morning that of the 24 potential jurists, 21 of them were familiar with the case through media reports. So it could be a bit of a challenge to pick a jury, but both sides seem pretty confident that they'll be able to complete that today and move on to the trial tomorrow.
And despite that familiarity with this story, Senator McAllister's lawyer has not tried to change the venue of this court proceeding.
He has not. And that was something they decided proactively to do, to not seek a change of venue. It's really probably a two-edged sword in the sense that potential jurors know Senator McAllister very well and are familiar with the details of the case. But then they also might have some allegiance to him as a longtime lawmaker from Franklin County.
Neil, it sounds like this is set to be a very speedy trial. I mean, from what I've been reading, it's expected to just last 2 days.
That's correct. They believe that this trial will go Wednesday and Thursday and be wrapped up this week. I suppose it all depends on what transpires during the trial and what the witnesses have to say.
And then his second trial, when is that supposed to start?
As far as I know, that trial is not yet set. That will be determined at some point after this first trial.
Neil, what do you know or what are you hearing about how the alleged victim in this case is dealing with all of this?
So we have not heard a lot from the victim or really at all. As far as I know, there was one interview that she did with Paul Heinz of 7 Days. Other than that, the alleged victim in this first trial, the legislative assistant, has said very little to the media, and we will hear her sort of take on what transpired between her and the senator this week when she is expected to take the stand.
And of course, you know, I guess we could say it is probably pretty apparent to people at this point, but most media outlets don't name victims in trials unless they choose to be named themselves and put their names out there. But we won't be naming her.
Correct. Yeah.
So what about the other trial and the alleged victims in that case? What do you know about what they're saying?
We know that in the other trial, there's plenty of evidence that police have collected and prosecutors plan to use against Senator McAllister. They believe they're very confident in their case. But what we don't know yet is how the stories will hold up when the alleged victims take the stand. So what media and the rest of Vermont and Franklin County are interested in is seeing how credible the stories are as they are sort of questioned by both the prosecution and the defense.
In these trials, we do expect to see some other lawmakers having to get involved. Some are expected to have to testify in at least one of the trials. Who and why?
Yep. Senator Kevin Mullen from Rutland was a roommate of Senator McAllister, and Representative Timothy Corcoran of Bennington was also a roommate of Senator McAllister. So we do expect that they will be called to the stand to testify in this case. Another House member, Representative Corey Parent from St. Albans, apparently gave some rides to and from the State House to the alleged victim, the legislative assistant or intern. So it's possible that he may as well take the stand.
And this is partly because the alleged victim in this case stayed with
Correct.
Senator McAllister at this apartment in Montpelier that he shared with these other senators, other lawmakers.
That's correct. She was apparently a frequent overnight guest at the apartment they all shared as she performed her duties as a legislative intern.
What is Senator McAllister saying about his political future at this point?
Well, we know that he believes that he is innocent, and he has planned to fight this case in court. He has filed for re-election, and if the trial comes out the way he believes it will and believes it should, that he is ready to seek re-election.
Reporter Neil Goswami of the Vermont Press Bureau. He's been covering the McAllister story for the last year. And you can read his reporting in the Barrie Montpelier Times Argus and the Rutland Herald. Neil, thanks as always for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We mentioned that several lawmakers have been subpoenaed to testify in the trial that begins tomorrow. Three reporters were also subpoenaed, Mark Davis and Paul Heinz of 7 Days, and VPR's Peter Hirschfeld. The three reporters were represented in court yesterday by attorney Bob Hemley.
Reporters get in this situation when doing their job, they go beyond simply reporting events and do some independent investigation, which is a good thing. And that's why there is a restriction on the use of reporters as witnesses of convenience so that they don't become easy targets for parties to a case who want to avoid doing their own investigation or who find it easier to use reporters.
And Bob Hemley was trying to get the reporters to not have to testify. He was trying to quash the subpoenas. Yesterday, Judge Robert Mello ruled that two of the reporters, Mark Davis of 7 Days and Peter Hirschfeld of VPR, will have to testify in the McAllister trial. Prosecutors argued that McAllister admitted to Mark Davis that he had sex with one of the alleged victims, which McAllister later recanted. Hemley says the circumstances that led to Davis being subpoenaed are unusual.
This case is different because McAllister did not follow the advice of his counsel, and in this case, spoke to the press. That doesn't happen very often.
Hirschfeld was subpoenaed to verify the accuracy of a quote McAllister made in a press scrum at the State House. Hirschfeld asked McAllister if he had sex with one of the alleged victims, and approximately a dozen people heard McAllister say no. Hemley argued on behalf of VPR's reporter that prosecutors could verify that information without relying on the journalist. Prosecutors say they are unable to identify the other witnesses to the comment, and Judge Mello ruled that because Hirschfeld is being only asked to authenticate a recording, he does not have First Amendment protections in this case. But Hemley argues there is a chilling effect on journalism whenever reporters are subpoenaed in trials.
The concern is that the use of reporters who do investigations in order to get news and insight to the public will refrain from doing that because they don't want to become witnesses in courtroom proceedings. That's the concern, and that's the policy argument that is made on behalf of the press.
Now, obviously, VPR has an interest in this case. We also feel this is an important issue to bring to you, our audience. VPR's Taylor Dobbs will be reporting on the McAllister criminal trial that begins tomorrow. We end today on a musical note with Timeline, a series produced by James Stewart of VPR Classical. In each story, James introduces us to events, characters, and concepts that shaped Western music. Today, James takes us through the idea of art, as defined by Richard Wagner. But we start in this century, and I bet you can name this tune in just a couple of notes.
Of course, it's the main theme from John Williams' score for the film Star Wars. The Star Wars franchise has become a cultural touchstone all around the world. The original 1977 film is a marriage of a universal mythological tale told with fantastic artistry. The sets, costumes, characters, special effects, and of course, the music all work together to create one experience. Film has truly become a prime example of the aesthetic ideal championed by Richard Wagner, Gesamtkunstwerk, or total universal art. Wagner first used this term in an 1849 essay entitled The Artwork of the Future. He believed that art, with a capital A, was originally one thing. Music and dance, word and image, were all unified in harmony, exemplified by the theater of the ancient Greeks. He argued that ever since then, art had been fragmented into disparate disciplines, robbing each of their combined affect. Wagner's vision was to put art back together again. His means of performing this feat was through the opera stage. For Wagner, 19th century opera was extremely lacking. He saw it as nothing more than pieces of vocal music strung together on a loose thread of story. The music was the goal, and drama was just an excuse. Wagner sought an expression of opera where the drama dictates the music. In his works Tristan and Isolde, Parsifal and the Ring Cycle, he sought to model a form of opera where all the different elements, the music, the libretto, the gestures, the sets, and the costumes, combined to create one experience for the audience. He even had a new theater built in Bayreuth called the Festival House, which was designed to immerse the audience in the sights, sounds, and feel of the drama. This concept of Gesamtkunstwerk, where different elements of art come together to make something greater and unified, has made its way into the aesthetic ideals of literature, the visual arts, and even architecture. Of course, that was the whole point. As Wagner stated, the artist of the future is not the individual poet, actor, musician, or sculptor, but the work itself.
Time Timeline is produced by VPR Classical host James Stewart, and it's made possible in part by a grant from the Ida and William Rosenthal Foundation. Go to VPR.net and click on Timeline for more episodes about music history. Vermont's election season has begun, and to prepare you for primary elections, we will be interviewing the leading gubernatorial candidates. Tomorrow, we'll hear from former V-Trans Secretary Sue Minter of Waterbury, one of three Democrats running for governor. You can send your questions for Sue Minter to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.